Hello, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards. International corporate tax avoidance is a growing concern for both advanced economies and low-income countries, and the changing nature of the global economy is putting added pressure on the international tax system.
So there is a lot of rethinking going on. I think there is a recognition that something has to be done. There are some proposals that are being discussed. Whether there will be enough consensus to move forward on these kind of remains to be seen. My name is Michael Keane. I'm a deputy director in the Fiscal Affairs Department here at the Fund, and I work largely on tax issues of various kinds.
Michael Keane was a lead author of a recent IMF policy paper that sets out the current state of the international corporate tax system and explores ways to address some of its shortcomings.
So you say in this paper that the international tax system is under unprecedented stress.
Right.
So what is it about the global economy that's putting this pressure on the international tax system?
Well, I think we have to go back, sadly, about 100 years to figure out where we are now, because we're working under a system that was really put in place pretty much at the time of the League of Nations, when the world was much simpler. Quite a lot has happened since the 1920s in terms of economic development. We have, for example, multinationals are much more a part of the global economy and much more complicated in terms of their internal operations. So trade within companies has become much more important than it was at the time of the League of Nations. At the same time, also things like intangible assets have become more a part of business life, more a part of the value that companies create. So we've had these large changes in the world economy that have really put the century-old structure under particular stress. And we can see that stress, I think, a couple of ways. One is, of course, there's a lot of public discontent when people see that multinationals that are often household names are paying relatively little taxation. They can be quite surprised when they're spending hours on social media or in coffee shops to find out that these household name firms are paying relatively little tax.
Right.
So there is this popular discontent, I think, with how multinationals are being taxed at the moment. And we see also that governments are showing signs of discontent in a way with the system, in that we have seen and are seeing the introduction of new types of taxes, often related to digital activities, that are pretty much unprecedented and which no one really thinks are particularly well designed or suitable for the long term, but nonetheless are a response to the pressures that governments feel themselves and their tax systems now to be under.
Yeah, and so is this, the increasing digitalization of the global economy, is this adding to that pressure on the tax system?
Yeah, I think we would see that the digitalization is certainly very central to the debate. And there's a lot of debate about whether you can, for example, design tax regimes that apply specifically to digital activities. I think our sense is that that's going to be increasingly difficult. Essentially, everything is going to be digital in one form or another. So I think a number of the features we associate with digital companies, which are things like, again, a heavy reliance on intangible assets, also the ability to do a lot of business in countries without much of a physical presence there, are things that are particularly evident with a number of these kind of household name, digital social media platforms, search engines, so on. They're very much associated with those activities, but they're really not limited to those particular narrowly defined activities. They're really very much a part of business these days more generally.
And you mentioned physical presence there, and that opens up this whole other debate about how companies try and avoid taxation by profit shifting. How does that work?
Well, there's a whole industry built around finding ways to shift profits. Basically, the idea is that you're a multinational, and essentially, I need to step back a little bit and say how a multinational is taxed under the current rules. So basically, what happens is you look at a multinational and all the subsidiaries, branches, all the different entities that make up the multinational, and you try to tax those as if they were independent companies. That's what's called arm's length pricing. So if one part of a multinational is selling to another part, we have to kind of figure out what price to value that transaction at to get the profits in the right entity. And we use something that's called arm's length pricing, which is we try and figure out what would a couple of unrelated companies, what price would they agree to. So the point of that, why that creates opportunities for profit shifting, is because then it creates opportunities, possibility of shifting profits from entities within the group where the tax rate is high to entities within the group where the tax rate is low. And there are all kinds of ways to do that. I mean, the simplest is to say, imagine I'm in a high tax jurisdiction, so I want to have low receipts and low profits on that account. So I might set a low price when I sell to another entity in a lower tax company in the group. And I want to have a lot of costs in that high tax region, so I may borrow a lot of money in that company, or I may want to pay higher prices for the inputs I purchase. So that's kind of playing around with what are called transfer prices and this kind of what we call debt shifting, using borrowing to move profits around. But that's kind of profit shifting 101. People make very well-paid careers by finding more creative ways of doing things. And another way, as you mentioned, is increasingly the ability to actually avoid having much of a physical presence, because the other element of the League of Nations system I mentioned is that for corporate tax purposes, you're really only liable in countries where you have a physical presence. Basically, the system was built for a world in which if you were active in a country, pretty much you would have a bricks and mortar factory or something like that, something very right. tangible. But of course, now it's much easier to do business in a country without actually having much of a physical presence.
So we have countries that are trying to attract businesses, right? They're always trying to create employment and they want to attract investment. And there is tax competition in terms of countries trying to lower the corporate tax rates to attract businesses. Is that actually effective? And How much do countries stand to gain by adopting more efficient tax policies?
Well, there's quite a lot going on here. There's both, and I should say the kind of profit shifting we talk about is essentially legal. There are obviously gray areas and disputes and so on, but we're talking about tax avoidance here. There are all kinds of considerations countries will have. Sometimes they, as you say, they do want to attract real business. And there, for example, we'd have to look not only at the headline rate of tax, but at things like what kind of allowances are provided for investment, what other tax attractions may be offered, are there kind of tax holidays, for example. So there are countries that try to attract real business in this way. I think other jurisdictions are really essentially largely looking for tax base. They want to shift the profits in. There may not be much real activity associated with these profits that are shifted in. So I think we have in mind both these two elements in a way of how governments compete to attract. There's both trying to attract essentially paper profits that are being shifted in, and there is the effort to attract real activity. In terms of the question of how effective this is, there's been quite a lot of work in the last few years trying to figure out how much profits does actually get shifted. And the answer there, the OECD comes up with a number of about 10% of on average of corporate tax revenue may be being moved around. We've done our own work, which comes up with slightly higher numbers. And really, since the last few years, there's been a bit of an industry in trying to figure out how large these profit shifting effects are. They vary quite a lot by country. So some of the estimates for the United States, for example, say it might be between 15 and 25% of corporate tax revenue.
Wow.
Then there's the impact on kind of real investment. And there I think it is the case that taxes do have an impact on where companies locate. But by and large, there are all kinds of other considerations companies have when they locate. When they think about real investments, they think about the security of property rights. They think about availability of reliable energy supplies, all these kind of things. So it does make a difference, tax considerations to real investments. Although the kind of surveys of business opinion, so far as one can sort of take those as definitive, say that, yes, tax matters, but other things kind of matter rather more in terms of investment decisions.
So it seems that it's mostly advanced economies that are sort of shaping international corporate tax laws and tax rules, and yet low-income countries are really the most affected by these rules.
Yeah.
Do you think that they're adequately represented in this process?
Well, you're quite right that when you look at these estimates, in particular profit shifting effects, clearly the dollar numbers are much bigger when you look at the advanced economies. When you look at the low-income economies, on the other hand, while the dollar figures are smaller, relative to GDP or relative to tax revenue, they're larger for low-income countries. One reason that matters, I think, when we think about what we want to do with revenue mobilization in low-income countries and achieving sustainable development goals, is that there are fewer alternative sources of revenue in low-income countries. Many low-income countries, a corporate tax may boil down to relatively few foreign enterprises or the mines and the telecoms and so on, which is a relatively manageable source of revenue. What are their alternatives? Well, the VAT in many of these countries is kind of under stress. Personal income tax is still being developed. And tariffs are, if anything, something we want to, in the longer term, reduce rather than increase. Whereas in many advanced economies, of course, you can say that, well, there may be actually other sources of revenue they could go to, might even be more efficient than the corporate tax. So you're quite right, I think, certainly in all our work, and I think increasingly in the international debate, there is particular concern to make sure that low-income countries' interests are represented in this debate that's now very, very intense. Importantly, the OECD, which has had a very strong role in setting standards in this area, has established something called the Inclusive Framework, which is essentially open to anybody who commits to various measures that have already been agreed. So that, I think, has about 129, 130 members now. Hmm. So that does, I mean, that's a big step forward, I think, in terms of including a wide set of countries in the debate. I think it's still the case that, that the large countries have high capacity to deal with these issues. They have a lot of experience. They have a big impact on the decisions that are made. So I think it is a continuing challenge, which I think everybody's trying to rise to make sure that the low-income countries, given not least their particular vulnerability on these issues, have a large say in the outcome. But I think ultimately the jury is still out a little bit on how much it's going to be even practical to take into account these diverse interests. So you can imagine getting 129 countries to agree on something like tax issues ultimately boils down to who's going to get the money, and that gets quite difficult to negotiate in a way.
So I was going to ask you if there was, in fact, an international body that oversees international corporate tax, and you mentioned there the OECD. Is the OECD the only game in town when it comes to international tax policy oversight?
I think the two sort of organizations that have had a role in standard setting, in kind of putting all the detail around this this very old system that I described, have been the OECD and also the United Nations. Mm. The OECD, I think, has taken a particularly strong role, largely and with the support of the G20. And I think the OECD recognizes that for a sustainable agreement, it has to extend beyond OECD members to include a wider set of countries as is possible.
So that oversight, that international oversight, is important, right?
Yeah, and I think it's kind of I think it's very noticeable that we have in the trade area. The world over the last decades has built up a World Trade Organization with various rules and so on. There's nothing similar to that in the international tax area. And I think one of the kind of conceptual issues we're trying to figure out is, well, precisely why is that? And it's partly to do with senses of national sovereignty, that tax is a sovereign matter, but then, so are tariffs, as we see. And countries do concede various taxing rights. So there's a whole network of about 3,000 or so treaties between countries. So countries do concede some rights. But I think it's also that the world doesn't really have an agreed set of principles for international taxation. Intellectually, you can say that at least on the trade side, there's a kind of a well-developed intellectual framework that inclines many people towards free trade. Many economists, of course, see the case for free trade. There's nothing similar on the international tax side. But I think the more positive point is that the kind of stress that we were talking about has brought the world to a point where people are really thinking about quite fundamental changes to the system more than they have since the 1920s, I would say. Hmm.
So as the pressure builds, how do you see the role of international institutions like the fund, like the IMF? What's their role in all this?
Well, I think we have a very important role to play. We're not the fund is not a standard setter in the sense of the OECD or the UN, and we have no desire to be a standard setter in this area. But I think we see three particular areas where the fund can contribute without we don't have any particular outcome that we are pushing. We do have clear views on some of the criteria that we think alternative schemes should be judged by. People may differ on how much importance they attach to those. So people may differ, for example, in how much they care about what a scheme implies for tax competition relative to what it implies for receipts in low-income countries. So there are some clear criteria we can set out. And the three areas, I think, are one in thinking through those criteria in terms of specific proposals, actually understanding what the impact would be. One example being, well, what would particular schemes imply for the intensity of tax competition? What would they imply for incentives to invest? That's a kind of, at one level, that's a sort of conceptual issue. And that leads to the second aspect, which is putting some numbers on these things to actually get a sense of how much different schemes would, what they would mean in terms of how much revenue, who would get the revenue, incentives to invest. And we think that's a very important part of the current debate, because while there's a lot of focus on what the various alternatives would mean in terms of changing treaty provisions, these kind of legal detail, you know, at the end of the day, countries are going to ask, well, you know, do I win or do I lose from
this? Yes, of course.
So we want to kind of do a little bit more work on. We do quite a lot of work on that, and we're in close touch with the OECD on what they call the impact assessment of these alternative schemes. And the third, is in our capacity development work with lower-income countries, which, of course, we do for many years. We've done a lot of, and including on international tax areas, because, of course, a lot of our work in low-income countries, we're looking at tax reforms of various kinds. And really, as soon as you look, for example, at any issue of business taxation in any country around the world, you get very quickly into issues of international tax. So we have a very active engagement with our members, including the lower-income members. And I think we also, importantly, looking forward, see an important role for the fund in trying to articulate as clearly as we can what exactly the interests are of the low-income countries that we need to make sure are fully taken aboard in this debate, including not least, of course, simplicity. Because although there have been important developments, I should mention, over the last few years in this area with something called the Base Erosion and Profit Shifting Project of the OECD, BEPS, I don't think anyone claims that's been a great simplification. And, of course, many international tax is pretty complicated stuff. And so though one shouldn't be, you know, have unrealistic expectations on how simple any tax system should be. This is clearly a major concern for many of the countries we work with.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Michael Keen is a deputy director in the IMF's Fiscal Affairs Department and a lead author of Corporate Taxation in the Global Economy. You can find that paper and other research on the topic at imf.org. And if you like this podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.